Thank you, Aloka, for being with us today. Today's conversation, we'll have it for a slightly different audience. It's not an audience who knows Sri Aurobindo and the mother yet. It is sort of for the 10-year-old Divyanshi, when I did not know about Sri Aurobindo and the mother and how transformative, future-looking, path-breaking vision that they have for the world. Yet something in me was seeking. And I feel today there is a lot of people, young, old alike, who are beginning to be dissatisfied with the world, life, ordinary life as it is, and they're beginning to seek. They don't know yet Sri Aurobindo and the mother, how their yoga is different from the traditional yoga. Maybe they don't yet even know what exactly is yoga. Though there is a happy, delightful change in the world that people are beginning to realize that it is certainly more than asanas. So if you had to introduce integral yoga, Sri Aurobindo and the mother's vision, to that seeker, how would you introduce that?
That's a wonderful way to put it. So there is a worldwide seeking, and the reasons for this seeking are many. They are not just physical. It's because mankind has entered a individualistic subjective age. That's how Sri Aurobindo and the mother put it. So whatever was the standard format in which life was throwing its seeds, for example, religion, and if I say sectarian spiritual paths, these are the two formats in which man's higher seekings have been nourished. But there have been also independent wayfarers on the path who do not go into any of these formats. So there has been a seeking, but the entering into the lanes have been through these two standard formats. Either you adopt a religion, go deep into it, or whatever religion you are born in, or you take to one of these sectarian, almost cultish, but cult is a little different, approaches, where you pick up one path, one method, one way, etc., etc. But none of these really fulfills or satisfies us in a complete way what we are seeking. So religion gives us a balm about, it gives us a ticket for another world where all that we have been seeking will be fulfilled, which is a question of belief. Nothing wrong in belief, but that's where the problem lies. So lead a life, righteous life, pious. I'm not talking of Sanatana Dharma for a moment, but standard format of religion. Now, more and more youngsters are able to see through it because it's being given in two attractive packages. You just change your name and you got it. Now, anyone understands, any right-thinking person, rational person, because we are also entered the curve of reason, understand that it's not as simple as that. There is something which is missing. I mean, I may change my name, I may change my outward religion, but if I don't change myself within, if I remain the same person, the same brute, what difference does it make? So this is something which has gone. So religion is, people are dissatisfied with religion, standard format of religion. Once again, I am not including Sanatana Dharma. The word religion is very different from dharma. And as to spirituality also, there is a new tendency where instead of just exploring or entering one cult or one sect, there is a larger wide seeking. Especially, now here comes the difference, that in traditional spirituality, you are given most of the paths, fairly acquainted with. At the end of the day, you are told that you can have nirvana or moksha. Subtle differences between the two, but fundamentally the same. That means you quit this world, this cycle of birth and rebirth and death, And again, either you have a heaven of, I use the word disenchantment with earth, so everything is fine. Or else you have an extinction, if you take the Indian thought, extinction in the one. This has been the offer so far. But as I know more and more youth, I myself have gone through that phase, this doesn't satisfy. It's like it raises more questions than it solves them. As a materialist, you say, okay, this world is the way it is, that's it, you accept it. But the moment you say there is a reality, higher reality, then it becomes very uncomfortable to accept the world as it is. You have to be blind to somehow say that, totally blind, to say everything is right. And to explain it on the basis of karma, that somebody did a bad karma 10 lives back and therefore he is suffering, even if he is a very good person. I understand to an extent. So, idea of cosmic justice, the way it is put forth, rudely, brutally, almost turning God into a worse, you know, he should be full of compassion. So if he's full of compassion, then this idea of sinning and all this. So this whole thing that when you look at the world of appearances as it is now, and the deeper reality as spiritual experience confirms, then there is a big disparity. As I said, the path of mukti as it is understood, Sri Aurobindo speaks about it, but in a different way, of transit, exit, it leaves a big gap between the world we inhabit, its origin, its goal, if any, and the escape door that we are seeking. So today is a time when more and more youth want to affirm whatever, you know, they want to affirm themselves to start with. They want to have a more life-affirming spirituality. They don't want to have a life-withdrawing spirituality where they... And as a goal also, because majority of mankind does want, whether we like it or not, that world should become a better place. If you tell them that, no, it cannot be, the only way is mukti and it's all because of the karmic thing going on, one may accept it like a weak... in Hindi, there is a term, hara hua. You know, a person who takes it that, okay, it's a lost case, this world and humanity, and they may accept it, but it can never satisfy you. There is a difference between acceptance and satisfaction. More and more youth are in that genre, that they are seeking for, they have a thirst for this world becoming beautiful, for their human life becoming beautiful, for their love becoming beautiful, for their everyday living being uplifted to something higher. This is where Sri Aurobindo steps in. Because he says, yes, not only is it possible, it is the reason, ultimate reason for spiritual life. It is the very purpose for which existence has come into being. It is the goal of humanity anyways. So he says that we are subconsciously seeking what yoga, at least the yoga, integral yoga, is there to offer to us consciously. Subconsciously we are seeking our own idea of perfect life. Well, perfect word has many connotations, but there's that thing should be beautiful. Let's put it like that. Happy, harmonious, but it is not. So this paradox, Sri Aurobindo is the only one who really, really resolves it to the utmost. So I feel for the modern youth, I don't see any other. I mean, I have also gone through this phase of inquiry and reading.
I have many, many follow-up questions coming. I'll enumerate 2 to 3 in one go and then you see how you want to take it. One is, you parked Sanatan Dharma separately. I want you to elucidate on that a little bit more. Second question that I have is, I've seen many times, it's sometimes not understood when Sri Aurobindo says make of life divine. It is somewhat seen as making the world a better place, like humanism. And that has kind of been a part of other parts of spirituality also. Be compassionate, be good people, do better to the world, do good to the world. But I feel what Sri Aurobindo is talking about is evolution, which is completely different. a spiritual life which is completely different. So what is that difference between the two?
So we'll come to both. Very beautiful question, by the way. So one is with regard to Sanatan Dharma. So I differentiate between Sanatan Dharma and religion as we understand it. I'm not putting it into this or that framework. So most of the religions, there is one founder, there is a book or a few books and a few people who run in sequence. And then their goal is ultimately through a certain practice, you enter into moksha at the most. I'm talking of the ultimate. But if you look at these Semitic religions, yes, the goal is not even moksha. It is judgment. So God is largely a judge. So in Sanatan Dharma, God is not a judge. Judgment is there, but that job description is with, who records all your script with Yamaraj. So, you know, he is the person who is the secret eye recording everything. So it is his job description, not God's. God is not a judge. He is all compassionate, who releases us, or Saturn and Surya, Sunny and Surya. So Sanatan Dharma, first of all, accepts that there is something called as the consequence of what we are doing, but that's not the ultimate thing. There is something much greater. It brings into a bold relief compassion. It brings grace. And even when it talks of moksha, I mean, I'm now less than, not sure, Bindu, exactly, it admits evolution. So if you read the works, all the works, Bhagavad Puran, for example, Ramayana, Mahabharata, so very clearly one can see that it admits the evolutionary journey from one life to another. So the idea of rebirth is something very beautiful about all Indic religions, actually, even the atheistic. And it gives you, now I'm again not going into the details how an atheistic religion which doesn't accept the soul talks about, that's a different subject. But the idea of evolution, the soul's journey or something which grows from life to life is very beautiful in Sanatan Dharma. It means that, to paraphrase, Zindagi Milegi Dobara. Okay, so, and it's because we need to evolve, we need to correct. It's no point at the end of the day you punish me or you give me a chance to learn and correct. So this idea of learning and growing, progressing. Now this is implicit in Sanatan Dharma. The idea that the divine is not only above and beyond, but he is within the heart of every creature is very, very unique to Sanatan Dharma. And it is something very beautiful. And that's the reason why Sanatan Dharma survived all the onslaughts. You break a temple, you burn the books, you do whatever you like, you convert people. But you cannot remove that presence which is in the heart. See, this presence will bounce back. Majority of at least those who are into Sanatana Dharma accept this as a doctrine that God dwells in your heart. And from there comes the compassion towards creation. It's not just because he's in my heart, but he's in every heart. So our dealings with people, our dealings with nature, now we are talking about Gaia and Earth and, you know, we should be all kinds of balances. But why these imbalances came? If you go to the root of it, when you accept that divine is present in matter within you, at one point it was there in Indian thought. That way we deviated from that is a different story altogether post Mayavad. But essentially that the divine reality is present in, imminent in every aspect of creation. This is very unique to Sanatana Dharma and very, very beautiful. That you evolve, this evolutionary principle is unique to Sanatana Dharma because it's not just one life. Even the avatars evolve. There is a collective evolution, not just an individual evolution. Now where Shurvindu steps in is that, well, does this evolution end suddenly with the soul's realizing? I mean, there are many other aspects, but I'm just touching the core. So, does this evolution stop with the soul realizing that I am that, as it is put, you know, tattvamasi? Or the realization of the soul is the beginning of a new journey. So, what you are mentioning about humanism, it's a step. What if you take the Indic thought, it'll be like sattvic nature. But sattvic nature still doesn't tell you that you are divine. You are still a struggling human and you should be good. And you should be brotherly to each other, though very frankly, it takes away the ground below your feet. The moment you say that all this is illusion, or the moment you say that all this, ultimately you are being just and go somewhere, or you say, like in Mahayana Buddhism, that at the end of the day, there is no divine reality, then frankly, you have taken the ground below the feet. Why should I be brotherly and good towards anyone? I mean, that's wrong, but let alone that part, instead of going into the semantics of it. The thing is that, is moksha the end point where the soul realizes its truth of oneness with the divine? And does it then leave this whole creation that, well, my job is over? I compare it to something in my profession as a doctor. I used to say, okay, you go through a big, difficult passage, you learn medicine after spending so many years, hard labor. Supposing, after finishing, I say, now I am a doctor, I can heal myself, and therefore I go to some place to enjoy. I mean, it's so absurd and illogical. Now the next step should start. So this freedom of the soul from ignorance is common to all yogas. Humanism is something like a sattvic humanity. It's not yoga. We can say it's a subconscious yoga. The urge in man to progress, to become better and better, which is fine. Nothing wrong with that. But that's not what Sri Aurobindo is speaking about. So yoga means union. So union of what? First I discover who I am, that is an individual soul. That's another big subject. Whether there is an individual soul or not. But again, I'm not going to the semantics. And then what is the consummation of this soul? Just, okay, I am free and I go away. Does such a freedom exist at all? That's another question. Well, its consummation is that it can become one with its origin, not to annul. Here comes Sri Aurobindo, something very unique. Because the central being, which becomes the psychic being, owes its origin in the supramental, before time and space. And therefore, the soul recognizing the divine, becoming one with the divine, does not necessarily mean annulment. It means it becomes now a conscious channel and instrument of the divine forces, which are anyways working in the world, but through screens and veils. And in human beings, through the veil of the ego. In human beings, through plenty of veils. So even a yogi, when he realizes the divine, it's the veils in nature are still there. So how did traditional yogis do it? They said, okay, I am free inside. It doesn't matter what's happening outside. Okay, still I have to deal with people. Okay, I can be compassionate because, you know, something of that naturally develops. Compassion I can help to an extent. Maybe as a master you can tell people, look here, here is the home, you too can come out. That's the maximum possibility. But Sri Aurobindo speaks of that, well, if we do that, few may escape. Maybe we'll make people a little more kind and human life a little more happier. But it doesn't touch the core problem. Most human beings, even sattvic human beings, as we see in Mahabharata, what happens to Yudhishthir? So you have always a dark lining. It's there. He uses the word inconscient. Even the most sattvic human beings, there are moments when he could be otherwise. In that one moment, he could destroy a whole empire. What did Yudhishthir do? Man, rarely you will find an example of a sattvic, cultured, refined, right-thinking human being. And yet, he actually put at stake not only his family members, his whole kingdom. He had no right to put his kingdom at stake, he put it. So it is to show to us that there are limits to which humanism and goodness can take us. Okay, what about spiritual life of, transition? There is another limit. Limit is, I can be free. But then, am I really cut off from this whole creation? That contradicts the fundamental experience that things are interconnected. So when I do that, what I am doing is basically a kind of selfishness. It's a very subtle kind of selfishness. It's like my clothes are dirty. And this is not me. I take them off and take a bath. And then I walk away. So what I have done, I have left my clothes here. Who will wash it? Somebody has to do the laundry. This is what we have been doing till now. So actually, this moksha, individual moksha, is a kind of subtle egoism, subtle selfishness. It doesn't come as that garb. It looks very nice. So that person renounced the world and went away. And I have so many stories about so many people of this kind, but that will make it very long. So, but the fact remains that it doesn't solve anything. You have just left your dirty linen for somebody else to wash. That used to be my problem with some of these bhajans. I said, because here, the problem is here. It's like if I say, look here, I have a problem with my house. And you give a solution as a counselor. You know what? This house will always have problems. You leave the house and go away. Now, another house, there will be another problem. Ultimately, you say that actually, you know, this world is a big house is a problem. That's not a solution. That is the message even of the Gordian knot, which people misinterpret. Gordian knot is if you cut it, you have not solved it. And you will not conquer the world. This is what happened to Alexander. Unfortunately, people misquoted. He came up to Indus and went back. But solving the problem is not cutting the knot. Solving the problem is to undo, understand the intricacies. And that's what people find little difficult about Sri Aurobindo, because then he doesn't talk about cutting the knot. He talks about solving the problem, removing the intricacies, looking at it closely, and most important, putting in it the leaven of divine love, which alone can change it. But people don't want to go into moksha. Looks very simpler. It's a subtle selfishness. So what Sri Aurobindo speaks about is something which has never been spoken about, is transformation of nature. However good and compassionate I may be, if my nature is based on ego, sattvic ego, or the ego of a mokshvadi, it will always remain incomplete. My action will remain incomplete. Secondly, I won't even understand the problem unless I have extended my individual consciousness into what can be called as a universalization. This is a problem which as counselors we all face. We easily tend to give a solution. But that's not where the person is. His ground is different. So to understand, we must also extend into the cosmic being. That's what Sri Aurobindo brings it. That man, before he leaps into the transcendent, which is where Buddha from, he has to recover all the three levels, the divine within us, which some mystics speak about. It will change our life, bring in true compassion, not the humanism wala compassion. Because as you discover the divine within, you develop a kind of compassion, very naturally, is the effect of that. But also the divine within all, not just human beings, not just animals, but in every object of existence. So that becomes the extension of the individual into the cosmic realization. But even beyond that, because again, cosmic consciousness is limited not by the individual, but by the forces that are at play. Cosmos is like a box. So some things have come into the play for various reasons. And the transcendent has secrets which is not yet released. So if you have to bring something new into creation which can change its nature fundamentally, then you have to tap into the transcendent. So all the three are there in Sri Aurobindo's yoga. One has to discover the individual divine. One has to extend into creation, cosmic being, and many other aspects. But also from the transcendent, this new consciousness, something which has not been there upon earth. It has been there in the divine, but not there. That's why the Gita also speaks of divine nature and human nature. So there is a way that divine can act, but we yet cannot act. But if we are his portions, we should be able to have an access. See the difference. So he talks about the divine supernature, which the Gita does speak of, and even the Vedas speak of as Aditi, but man must embody that nature. Divine compassion is very different. Shri Krishna is all compassion, and is also the Kurukshetra. So divine love is very different than this ego-striven human love, trying to make the world better.
Again, there are many questions that are coming to my mind, but I'm going to take one around the law of karma, because you mentioned it a few times. Also, personally for me, when I was seeking and I found Sri Aurobindo, one of the things that really brought a lot of peace in my heart was reading Sri Aurobindo and Mother's writings on the law of karma. I particularly remember reading a little story by the mother where she says that, you know, it could be that a very noble soul who wants to progress on earth has taken birth in a poor household instead of a rich household as a choice, because that helps him progress more. And that was very different from the understanding of karma that I saw in and around myself. I even saw some people, you know, if somebody had a disability or an abnormality, say, oh, that person must have done something bad in the previous lifetime. Or as a parent, when you get a child who has some limitations, instead of focusing and celebrating the gifts of that child, saying that, you know, it's a karma. And that used to really, really bother me. And when I saw this understanding very simply given in the form of a story by the mother, for me it was like a balm on my heart, because I was like, it can't be that such a profound civilization has given such a profound concept to the world and it means this. It had to mean different. So if you can share, what does it truly mean? Because we use it quite often in India.
So first thing is that karma is not a tribunal of justice. Karma is a evolutionary mechanism. Once we make this fundamental difference, meaning thereby it's not a system of reward and punishment, but it's a system of learning and growing. This is a basic idea about karma. So people are evolving based on who they were in the past. Now I'm taking on from there. Towards an higher and higher evolution. So they will go through the experience which will lead them further and further. So they are not being punished. And after the punishment is over, okay, you try again, and now if you don't work out, because that is an absurdity. Also the popular notion that what is reward and punishment itself is a very questionable thing. A rich family is not necessarily a reward. As the Bible also says that it's a curse. It's easier to make a camel pass through the eye of a needle than to make a rich man turn to God. So this idea. As to disability, we have classic examples. Ashtavakra. Ashtavakra is bent at eight places. And Ashtavakra is Jnani of Jnanis. Is one of the Janak's guru. Janak is a lineage. So one of the Janak's guru. So this idea is obviously absurd, and any sensitive heart, anybody who is little evolved, finds it repulsive. But it's very convenient. Why it is convenient? Because it gives you a lazy explanation of the way things are. So you don't have to do anything. If you are suffering, it's your past karma. And if you are, if somebody else is suffering, well, it's his past karma. So it has made us very lazy. Where did this come from? I really don't know, because if I read the Indian scriptures, it's not there this way. Now I'm taking a whole series on Bhagavad Puran. Just one story, very quick, fast forward, 2 minute story. Is there is a king who, or let's say Narad's story. Narad just wants to, he tells that I want to understand your Maya. He tells Sri Krishna, he says, okay, go my child, first get me some water because I'm thirsty. He goes and pulls water from a well. Just then, there is a beautiful lady who says, I can give you something much better, water. She says, okay. So, as he drinks, he falls in love. Then he goes there, gets married, has children. And one day, there is a forest fire and all of them die. And he is turning, blaming God. What a cruel person you are, and what have you done to me? And he hears a little voice in his heart, Narada, I am thirsty. And he wakes up. Now, this is of course, like all stories, they have limitation. But if you read through the Bhagavat, it's never described as you have done that sin and therefore. There is no sin and virtue. It's just that there is a life of ignorance and there is a life of knowledge. So in ignorance, we learn through errors. That's what ignorance is about. But we learn because it's inbuilt. So when we look at these stories, it's very interesting that man's life in ignorance, where he just identifies with the little ego, He makes a lot of, even what he thinks is right is a mistake, as we all know. Mistake in terms of its consequences, not in terms of its fundamentally. Naturally, one makes error. And as one makes error, through consequences, one learns. And also, there is inbuilt something which is helping him to grow. Then there comes a point where he wakes up that what is this game after all? What am I doing? How foolish it is. And therefore, a new journey starts, a journey in knowledge. Where he is in the world, if we take the idea of the Gita, not how it is nowadays that it's moksha. So the Gita's moksha is, then you are a conscious human being and you are now growing consciously. That's what yoga is about, that instead of dealing with the world unconsciously, because of which there is so much chaos, not only in the world, but also as an individual, we begin to act with the true knowledge. Now, naturally, when we begin to act with the true knowledge, we are Jivan Mukta. But problem is that our instruments are not trained to tune to knowledge. they react now. So, tuning the instrument, transforming them is Shrivindas Yoga. So, this is how the threefold life. One is life in total ignorance. It's not about reward punishment. We do, we learn by mistakes, so-called mistakes, and we grow through them. So, karma is not about reward and punishment, but a mechanism to help you grow. Then comes a life when, after a point, automatically, because what is growing? Not just a lifetime person. Deep within the soul is growing. So the soul grows to a point where it says, but what is this game after all? I want to understand it. Then comes the next phase of evolution. Then it discovered that, oh, I am the unstained one. I am always one with the divine. Then it has a choice. As we have seen, either it goes back or it says, well, but this understanding, this knowledge, this power, this love which has been released into me, now I can share it and make this world become a better place, which is why this creation has been formed. So, law of karma, the way it is understood is obviously, any it jars with even our noblest understandings of the divine. Again, divine as judge or divine as something much greater. So, that's why always you see, I can take classic example, just three or four, I'll mention the names. If the law of karma was so important, the way it is traditionally understood, then how can one explain that Duryodhan was, and all his like, forever they ruled, from childhood till death. Mind you, they died, but died as rulers. So, does it mean that they were very good human beings? If so, why they changed to such miserable human beings, ambitious, suicidal, murderous? How did it come around? And if the Pandavas suffered from childhood, they've been in the forest. But look at their nature. They are such lovely people. Yudhishthir is saying, take away my kingdom. Arjun is saying, no, I won't fight. Such lovely people. Actually, they are adorable characters. Too adorable. And yet they have gone through till the end. Even later on, they go to Himalayas. So, were they bad people who were suffering due to karma, but God is with them and they have become, you know, ideals for Indian? Then, Bilva Mangal, the story of Jagai Madhai, of infamous fame. And even in the West, you see story of Saint Augustine. What does Augustine do? He is famous prayer, I want to be chaste, grant me chastity, Lord, but not yet. And he is, when you read his prayers, they are such beautiful psychic prayers. So if that is true, then there is no hope for Ratnakar becoming a Valmiki. So all this was very well understood. It is the post-Islamic and, you know, the Christian invasion that we adopted some of these things, got contaminated and started talking about sin and virtue and reward and punishment, which is just not there in Indian thought. It's a post this. Many of these are from Puranas. Many of the Puranas are post-invasions.
Okay, I have three more major questions that I'd really like you to share about. The first question is that there is certainly a spiritual rising which is happening. Also, more and more people wanting to understand about spirituality, wanting to understand about religion, the way, you know, spirituality and its laws work. However, I find today a lot which is being talked about in the name of spirituality is actually discourses about the occult. And that is also getting a lot of views, a lot of followers, a lot of traction. To give you an example, how do you do Devi Sadhana for material success? There's a lot of, that sort of a conversation which has today become very mainstream. So I want you to share about what is the distinction between occult, spiritual, and where do sciences like astrology, which can also be something very beautiful, but it also depends on how one practices astrology. Astrology can be a tool of spirituality, but not a tool of spirituality as well. So if you can share a little bit about what is the distinction between occult sciences and spirituality.
So this distinction is well known. And as you said, even people draw from the Vedas, for example, Putra Kamesh Yagya. So you seek a child. That's what the yagya means. I'm using this as an example. And lot of people turn towards the divine, even divine, with various forms of desire. How does the Gita put it? And how do the Upanishads put it? So some of them say that this is a Traigunya Vishya Veda. They have even used this word, which doesn't feel very good to a very strong traditionalist. That, the subject of the Vedas belongs to the three gunas, sattva, rajo, tama, and, whatever one may get out of them. He says, but there is something still higher. And the Gita, I'm quoting now the authority of Sri Krishna, just to make sure. He says that, for somebody who has realized, he has to go beyond the word written or spoken, and for somebody who realizes the divine, what is the role of the scriptures? I'm first coming to scriptures, all the Devi Sadhana, etc., which you mentioned. He says it is like a man who is in the ocean. If you say that, please fill this jug of water. So that is the role. It's nothing more than that because you have entered into the ocean. All great spiritual figures have spoken about it. But the common man is still enamored with, seeking for power. So we have a limited power. Can we augment this power? Should it be stopped or something? No, because it's a quest for power. It's a quest for knowledge and all quest is fine. It is done for selfish ends. Doesn't matter because there comes a time when, again, just like you are satiated, but not satisfied. None of this will ultimately fulfill the quest of man because you will realize that all this ultimately doesn't lead you to, because supposing you are doing a yagya for getting something. You have got something. Let's say that there are occult agencies and there are. What happens after that? There is a story in Bhagavad itself that there is a man who does all this. He is without a child and this shows the distinction. So he is told that you surrender to the divine and you accept how life is, let thy will be done. This spiritual, where you accept the will of God and you surrender. But he meets a yogi and says, no, all that is fine, but my heart is, I want a child, my wife wants a child, do something about it. So the yogi gives him an apple. And he says, make your wife eat it and she will deliver a child. But he again cautions, it's not the right approach because a child is not written in your life. Better you don't alter things this way. A very illustrative story. Just as a story it shows. It doesn't use these words. So anyways, he's happy and he goes and tells, so and so, yogi has given this apple. Please eat it. And now the lady is in a thought. She says, life is very happy without a baby. Why is he after a baby? I don't want a child. he wants a child. So, but what to do now? She has got the apple. So she passes it on to his sister is also pregnant. She gives a solution. She says, you eat it. You do one thing. You can pass on your child to me and say that you have bought it. Something like that. She says, okay, fine. That's a good solution. And she says, I'll see that probably I'll give my child to you if you still need. You think about it. So she says, okay. So she eats the apple and she gives birth to a child which is like a little looking like a cow. It's called Gokarna. This is the result of the yogi giving me a Appeal, thank God, you know, my sister is so kind. She passes the child to the sister. And meanwhile, sister delivers another child who is like a normal human being and very happy. So she passes it on to, there is a child exchange. Because he says, yeah, I think I should also have a child. It's good. Brahmin doesn't, the man doesn't know anything what has happened behind the scene. He is very happy that I have a child. Now this child goes by the name Dundakari. He is a devil in disguise. So what happens is that he has a child as a result of his prayers, intervention of a yogi, whole occult process. But this child gives him so much unhappiness that at the end of the day, he walks away into the forest. He says, I should have surrendered myself to the will of God and accepted. So now you see, this is one story there are plenty. It's one thing that you will get things by occult processes. There are occult processes like material processes. You want something today on cell phone, you can get something. Whether it's good for you or not is a different question. So getting things by occult processes, yes, you are interceding in the play of forces in the cosmos. And we don't go into that. There are cosmic beings who are there to give you this. But when you get the thing that you desired, you don't know what your experience is going to be. So spirituality understands this. It understands the cosmic play and its mechanisms. And true spirituality begins where you say, I surrender myself to you and accept your will. If I have a child, okay, I take it as your child and I do my best. If I don't have a child, I even accept that as your will. If I have money, let me use it the way you would want me to use it. If I don't have money, I accept it as a blessing. That is spiritual life. But occult is about same thing. Like it's an extension of science. Material science can create magic by material mastery or material forces. But occultism means behind the material forces, there are many other subtle forces. Even there are beings behind these forces. And there are ways by which you can come in contact with these beings. And they can help you get things which even ordinary science may not be able to succeed. But then does it make your life happier, better? Better in quality, that's a big question mark. So occultism is always regarded as a mixed thing. Some people can use it rightly, that's a different matter. Like some people can use their cell phone very well. Others get addicted. Most will get addicted.
I have another question actually. These days, the word Vedic is becoming very commonplace. So everybody is using Vedas. It comes from the Vedas. And a lot of times, actually, what they're referring to are Puranas, but they are referring to it as, this comes from the Vedas. And very specific certain rules and regulations, which may have been spoken in a certain context, are being taken, and one is putting it as it comes from the Vedas. In a certain sense, it's good, because one is reconnecting back to the fact that the civilization has its roots in the Vedic and the pre-Vedic civilization. But at the same time, we're using it very lightly. It comes from the Vedas. It is written in our scriptures. It is written in our Vedas, you know. So if you can distinguish, yes. What is the difference between Vedas and Puranas, and what really comes from the Vedas?
So, before even the Puranas. So basically, see, I'm going to draw a parallel which some people may not like, but, you know, just for understanding. So everybody quotes the Quran, okay? Quran has a whole section called Hadith. Now, if you read the Hadith, they are horror, many of them. So Hadith is instructions based on Quran, interpretations. So Vedas have something called as the original mantras, which were seen by the seers and given to mankind. But then you have two other elements which came up, which are Brahmanas and Aranyaks. So one is about the ritualism of the Vedic aspect, the Karmakanda, and the other is which has taken the other aspects of the Vedas and developed it. So it's a development. And the third is the Upanishad. Upanishads are straight away airlifted from the Vedas. So Upanishads have the same authority, you know, like they are basically culled out portions from the Vedas. So if you go back to the original Vedic literature, it's of course all about God-seeking, God-vision, and beautiful. But subsequently, fortunately in us, there are not things which are horrifying. But they can be misunderstood, like Ashwamedha. So Ashwamedha Yagya is the horse sacrifice. Now, if you read later scripture, they will talk about actually sacrificing a horse. Because the Vedas always spoke in terms of three layers. One is the deepest spiritual experience which the Vedas spoke. Then there is the symbol which is in language in which they, because people were not ready, they could misunderstand. They had their own reasons. And then there is something which appears like a purely surface literal meaning, which becomes absurd many times. Like Ghritashnu, the horse whose feet are dipped in ghee. You know, there is no such horse. So if you read like that, but if you understand horse is the force and grit is the clear mind. So a force which is moved by the clear mind is wonderful. So Vedas, yes, there is a tendency to quote. Now, still, these aspects of the Vedas, Samhitas, and then the Brahmanas, and then the Upanishads, and then the Aranyak. So this is a whole composite in which there are original verses and then there are things which have developed. Puran comes much later. So Puran, not that there is anything wrong with that. Now Puran understood that Vedas have a lot of symbols which are very difficult to put across. So the Puranic rishis, many of them were rishis, they explained the same thing in terms of stories which can be more easily comprehended. Bhagavad Puran speaks about the cow. And it speaks about the cow which is on one leg. Obviously, there is no cow which will walk on one leg. But she is walking on one leg. And there is a child by its side, a young fellow who is almost on the deathbed. So, when you look at the story and it says that this is the symbol. So, she is Dharma. And, you know, the four legs of Dharma which have been destroyed in Kali Yuga, only it's standing on one feet, which is faith. So, it describes that. In the Vedas, the symbols are much more deeper. In a way, easier to decipher because today we speak of horsepower. Today when we speak about light, we don't only think of this light. Light is a general word. So when the Vedas speak of light, they're speaking of the divine light. Materialists will understand it as material light. Some people will understand it as the inner light. But that is the source of light. So Vedas are speaking about that, which is the source of all things. Now, Puranas, again, there are authentic Puranas which are regarded as authentic because the seers were those who really, really had the revelation of the Vedas. And these Puranas have brought in something which is missing in the Vedas. For example, they have brought bhakti. So you have worship in the Vedas. But worship is different. It's more an intellectual thing. But bhakti where you give yourself. So Puranas was a development. And there is a difference between authentic Puranas, for example, Vishnu Puran and Srimad Bhagavat Puran, not because my favoritism, but Shravinda himself talks about these two are authentic Puranas. Because the writers are seers. They had the occult vision and therefore they have written. But you'll be surprised that even Shiv Puran is not regarded by many as authentic. Those stories are very beautiful. I love those stories. Agni Puran is not regarded as authentic. So, in Puranas, you have to be more careful because they are later development, the same truths. They are not like culled out from Vedas, but the same truth has been explained in ways which are relatable to the common man. So, there are many stories and simple things. But at the same time, there is a mixture which has come in. There are some new things which have come in because human consciousness evolved. Bhakti, especially in the Purana, is something very, very beautiful and profound. And if you see sheer poetry, images and poetry, then Puranas are lovely. If one can get into the poetic part of the Sanskrit literature, they are simply lovely. And then because even that is not sufficient, so there came Mahabharata and Ramayana. As now Vedas is there in Mahabharata, that's why it's called as the fifth Veda. But how to apply these things in our everyday life? So while going back to the Veda, as you said, is a beautiful thing, but there should be a clear understanding of all these things. People randomly quote scriptures. Suddenly they'll pick up from somewhere and they say, this is what is written about this Devi. So this Devi can grant me this. Therefore it's fine. Okay, it's fine. There's no problem. You want something. Somebody can grant you, it's perfectly fine. But see, you are closing your mind in something very limited. And it is in this context that the Gita says that, you know, Traigunya Vishya Veda. It is in this context that even the Mundaka Upanishad says. Mundaka Upanishad says, well, if you talk about the Vedas, the three Vedas are still in the realm of ignorance. Atharva Veda came later, but it would be included. It's a unique edition. But the three Vedas, it says that they are still in the realm of ignorance. They cannot set your soul free. It's there as an authority in the Mundaka Upanishad. So who can set you free is the being with the 16 parts. So always there is this idea, Vedas are profound truths, it's the secret knowledge. It contains occult truths, it contains spiritual truths, it hints at the highest, no doubt about it. But people take what they want to take. You go to, that's what Sri Krishna says, the four kinds of bhakta. You may go to someone who can set your soul free, but you may ask him for a good husband or a good wife. He will grant you. This is the difference. So most people don't know. So it's okay.
Since you have little time, I'm going to club to three questions. Yes. And in one go, yes. Sort of share. One is, what is the difference between a spiritual experience and the growth of spiritual being? Many times we talk about, oh, I had this experience in my meditation or that experience in my meditation. But does that necessarily mean that one is growing as a spiritual being? So that is my first question. Second question is, in integral yoga, we say all life is yoga. And there I have seen two misunderstandings, and even sometimes I have fallen into that misunderstanding as well. The first misunderstanding is that when you conceive of all life as yoga, you want to bring that spiritual essence in work. And then you start running after work, 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 which can actually distract you from the real path. So that is one misconception or little distraction that I find. The other thing that I have also found is many people justify being in life as it is because all life is yoga. So one justifies the way life is with all its limitations because we are living all life as yoga. So we don't need to do the tyag of many different things. So all life is yoga. Both I find are limited. And my third question is, then how do you really practice all life as yoga? How do you really practice integral yoga? Because some of those things that traditionally one used to do, one is not necessarily expected to do. And one has, in that sense, been given a very vast freedom by Sri Aurobindo and the Mother for each one to find one's own path and live it in one's own way. So sometimes one can't see, am I progressing? What are the indicators of progress? How do I know that, yes, I am operating from the deepest inner being and I'm progressing through that? So
yes, people misuse anything and everything. People are people. So that's where sincerity comes in. That if your mother would say, if you are not sincere, don't enter the path because it will burn you. If all life is yoga as life is, then nothing is required. There could be nothing more lazy. You know, it's a justification of the lazy that, well, anyways, all life is yoga. What it means is, all life is yoga is to be understood at two levels. One is that all life is subconsciously a yoga. Subconscious yoga means, say a person has a friend and he's unhappy with a friend and therefore feels sorry and feels hurt and pained and comes back and then has another friend and again feels sorry, hurt and pained. So one say, what has that got to do with yoga? It's a subconscious yoga. You are seeking perfection. As mother once said very interestingly, she said, well, you know, people who want their friend, maybe husband or wife, to be perfect, they want a personal divine to themselves. So Ted, my character. So obviously such a thing doesn't really exist. I mean, there could be a divine to yourself, but he will not be only to yourself. This exclusive idea. So the point is that basically justifying everything and anything is one way, but we can turn every experience of life, however painful, into a catalyst for something higher. That's because a subconscious yoga is going on. It means your life experiences are trying to tell you something. They're trying to teach you something, but we don't want to listen. We don't want to heed. We don't want to see. And therefore it comes again and again. So as a psychologist specifically, if you can unlock a hidden door, look at what you are looking. You are looking for perfection in someone, but you have to discover the perfection within you. You can develop yourself to a point where you can love truly and divinely. But if you are expecting somebody will love me truly and divinely, then that's silly. So basically, this is the first layer at which we understand all life is yoga. The second level is that, okay, if that is so, that something is already happening in us without our knowledge, how do I consciously participate in it? Now, conscious participation is where the yoga actually begins. So obviously, it doesn't mean I'll just continue my life only with the knowledge that anyways yoga is taking me. I have to do certain thing, meaning thereby there is a, it's well known. The Gita brings it out very beautifully, and so does Sri Aurobindo. So there is a life of ignorance in which also the divine is leading us, but hidden from us. I could elaborate in it in so many ways, you know, every fall, every struggle, every pleasure, every pang. There is a leading, divine guidance in life. And unknown to us, it is carrying us. This is subconscious yoga. The moment you want to take up the conscious yoga, then you have to see that what is the root cause of all this life of ignorance in which you have a mixed baggage of pleasure and pain. Who wants that? We are seekers of bliss. We are seekers, anandasya putra. We are seekers of true knowledge, not a mixture of error and knowledge. We are seekers of unlimited, infinity, not finite things. So then we have to very carefully distinguish between what is really a limiting life. So then we see the limiting life is a life of ego. This is the knot. So everything is at my disposal, but I want a small little thing. Why? Because I desire. See, desire and ego are thieves playing at each other. So ego tells, I want this. So desire says, I want this. Ego says, yes, 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 I must have this. So what has happened? All this tremendous energy, tremendous power, tremendous knowledge is limited into a small little tap water. So when we lead that life, as a corrective, it hits us back. We realize, my God, this is not what will make me happy because I thought I'll become happy. So all that is limiting us, all that is cabining us has to be out. That's the fundamental difference between a life of ignorance and a life of knowledge. That's the first thing. So what is it that is completely limiting us? It's ego. It's desires. So we have to make a choice. Now this choice many people hesitate to make. Well, oh, then what will my life be? Now they don't understand, that's why it's a leap of faith, they don't understand that a life driven by desire and a life driven by the higher truth, there is a world of happy, beautiful difference. So life of desire is running after wanting this, acquiring this. But when you are driven by the breath of God, so I could give this example at a very human level, like any example one has to take the difference. So imagine a horse which is being driven every day. It has to be, its master will give it something to eat and he is satisfied with that eating. Now imagine a horse which is far more conscious and is driven by Maharana Pratap. Now I'm not talking about Maharana Pratap is God or something, but I'm just giving an example. Now this horse knows that what my master is doing is to disinfect this land from the Mughals. And so this horse, when he carries him in one of his battles, he is immortalized in one of the poems. His Chetak, you know, his name has been immortalized. He was born in the ashram as a human being after, you know, mother has confirmed that. Because that's the same horse, but look at his power. No horse you can imagine can jump across a chasm the way this horse did. When he was faced a chasm, no horse would do it, who is living only for, you know, feed. But he knows the mission, he knows the master, somewhere deep within, I'm not saying conscious mind, but that's what, as an example only, it is able to cross that chasm and it dies. And then Marana Pratap pays homage to this horse. So similarly, when we are driven by the breath of God, rather than by the desired self, then all that the desired self could imaginably give us, we get it in much better quality, not about quantity. That's why the Isha Upanishad says, Tena Tyaktena Bhunjita Magrida Kasya Siddhena. When we know that all this is for the Lord, then what happens? You are renouncing things, but you experience delight. Tena Tyaktena, renouncing, Bhunjita, delight, you get delight. Strange. Because normally we think by having I get it, by renouncing I get it. How we get by renouncing? Not like a sannyasi. Inwardly, when I know that it is all for the Lord, yat kincha jagatyam jagat, it's not mine. This little change, nothing to be changed outwardly, but just to know it is not mine. I am not the possessor of this man, this woman, this house. It belongs to the Lord. It's his temple. I am here as a caretaker. Life would change. Yajnavalk speaks about it. That famous, you know, again, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, where there is a dialogue between Yajnavalk when he is leaving the house, and Shubhda quotes this in Synthesis of Yoga, Ascent of the Sacrifice, that he says now he has two wives and both he distributes his property equally. But Maitri, the younger one, says, elder is happy. Younger says, I can understand this, you are being very just and fair, you always have been. But tell me, where are you going? He says, for my deepest quest. He says, can I come along? He says, why do you want to come? Then she says that, I want to know, why does one love one's wife? Why does one love one's child? Why does one love the house, the nation, property, anything? Then Yajnavalk says, listen, Maitri, one does not love the wife for the sake of the wife, but for the sake of the self. One does not love the child for the sake of the child, but for the sake of the self. One does not love the house for the sake of the house, but for the sake of the self. Now you see, the traditional renunciation is, who cares, I'm going. That's not an act of love. That's selfish love, which we have spoken about, mukti. But the other is, now this does not belong to me. Okay, but this belongs to divine. Now see the difference. Can I just abandon anything outwardly because it gives me peace and satisfaction? I would deal with things divinely. And that is the difference. So outwardly, there is nothing which seems to be. Sometimes you have to leave things. But it is not left for any personal, selfish, egoistic purposes. So you leave. What do you leave? You leave selfishness. You leave egoism in relationship. You leave my desire in relationship. You leave the account of profit and gain. So why is the relationship there? Because that's the trust that divine has given me. And I must be true and faithful. Who to whom? To the divine. And if I do it, then I take leaps and bounds and progress. Same situation, same people, same things. I can deal with material things as if they are not mine. They are God's, divine's. How do I matter? Or I can deal with them that they belong to the divine, and therefore I must be lot more careful about them. This is the clue. All the rest is a development of that. In short, all life is yoga means that. Yeah.
Thank you, Alokta. And thank you for being so generous with your time as well. But I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. I felt so engrossed and so much into the conversation. I'm sure the people who are watching, it will clarify many of the misunderstandings, doubts, misconceptions that we have about spirituality, and at the same time give a very practical way of how do you progress on the path, or how do you aspire to progress on the path. Deeply, deeply grateful. Thank you. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks to you also, because seldom such questions are asked, I must say. It's very beautiful. And of course, many things are held back, like in Shobindra's yoga, surrender, and But that's not important. The core has been, that's the process of yoga. Maybe some other time.
Yes, I had a lot more questions to ask, but I'm also aware of the time, and that's...
Can always have some other time.
Yes.
Okay. It's been a joy.
Thank you.